You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 9th of November 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up:
what we know so far about the individual who we shot, who police shot, and has died at hospital. From what we know of that individual, we are treating this as a terrorism incident.
Police in Melbourne shoot dead a terrorist on one of the city's busiest streets, but should they have been taking an even closer interest in him? Also ahead, we'll look at how China might adjust their policy abroad in response to a US president weakened at home. We'll speak to the author Sarah Smarsh about her new book Heartland. We'll find out what was learned at the Future Cities Summit in Toronto. We'll have a preview of Monocle's big interview with Sally Field, and the global countdown returns and drops in on Cape Verde. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Among the many people trying to figure out what, if anything, the reversal suffered by US President Donald Trump in the midterm elections means for them are the Chinese Communist Party. Quite aside from the curious trade war Trump insists on conducting with Beijing, there are the ongoing tensions in the South China Sea, an indication of the degree of which has been revealed this week with the disclosure that in September, an American destroyer, the USS Decatur, had a near miss in the vicinity with a Chinese destroyer, the Lanzhou. A sharp starboard turn was required by the Decatur's crew to avoid a major collision. Well, I'm joined now by Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue. Isabel, it does sound like, it, from the reports that have emerged, like a fairly fraught scenario with American sailors throwing barriers over the side of the boat to try and ameliorate any accident and then having to throw that sharp right turn to get away from it. If the two ships had hit each other with damage to either the ships and or the personnel on either, how big a deal might that have been?
I think it would have been a very big deal indeed. And I think the closest analogy, if you cast your mind back to 2001, when an American military aircraft was buzzed a little too closely by a Chinese shock jock. There was a collision, mid-air collision. The Chinese crashed and the pilot was killed. The American managed to land on Hainan, and it then became a tremendous cause, of course, between the US and China.
This was very early in the presidency of George W. Bush,
It was indeed, and you know, massive kind of publicity in the United States about the fate of the pilot, who was returned unharmed, and even the plane was eventually returned, but it was shipped back in bits, and the Chinese had rather made the point that they had uncovered any secrets the plane had held, and that was pretty bad. And since then, of course, China has become much more aggressive, much more militarily powerful, and much less willing to back down. So I think this would have been extremely dangerous.
The United States says that in the last year there's been 18 what they call unsafe incidents, either at sea or in the air, which suggests that these kind of things are pretty common. And that being the case, do the actors on both sides factor in the possibility of mishap from time to time? Are there kind of protocols and strategies in place to deploy should a couple of ships or a couple of aircraft bang into each other?
In general terms, yes. I mean, the things like the code of conduct for unplanned encounters at sea, and you know, those are generally agreed between parties in where their ships are likely to run into each other. The problem here is that this is actually a territorial dispute, and which is being acted out in this rather dangerous way. So neither side is going to back down. What were the Americans doing there? They were doing what are called FONOPs, which is freedom of navigation operations, in pursuit of their insistence that the South China Sea is international waters and they have every right to sail whatever they like through there.
They're not wrong about that.
They're not wrong about that under international law. They are absolutely not wrong. But they're up against the Chinese insistence that basically the South China Sea is all China's, and regardless of the competing claims or indeed territorial waters of at least five of their neighbours. And the Chinese have militarized militarized the coral reefs of the South China Sea. They've built airstrips, they've installed military installations, and they patrol them very aggressively. And so there, you know, this is where the US-China battle over supremacy at sea in the Eastern Pacific is being fought out. And so, you know, the codes of conduct apply essentially when you encounter on the high seas or where there isn't another dispute that you're trying to kind of play out. This is really quite tricky. There's also, in theory, a long discussion between China and its ASEAN neighbours over codes of conduct at sea, because not only does China harass US military phone ops, but it also, with rather greater success, harasses its neighbours. Its neighbours' fishing boats have been, Vietnamese boats have been sunk by Chinese ships, either Coast Guard vessels or bigger fishing boats. And the Chinese have been harassing oil rigs that are drilling for oil in Vietnamese territorial waters. So there is a, you know, big pattern of Chinese assertion of Chinese power.
A lot of those neighbours, of course, being substantially easier for China to push around than the United States might be, which does prompt the question, at least from my point of view, that if these phone ops operations, these freedom of navigation operations, are perfectly legal, the United States ships are sailing in international waters, that's obviously they're perfectly entitled to do. What's the logic from the Chinese perspective of reacting? Why not just shrug and say, well, fine, it's international waters, sail up and down all day if you like, see if we care?
Because the Chinese say it's not international waters. The Chinese say these are historic Chinese waters, all of it, and, you know, get your warships out of here. And this is...
Are they ever going to be able to make that stick legally, though, internationally?
No, but they've had one ruling against them, remember, in The Hague,
the International Court of Arbitration
under the Law of the Sea, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. It went against them, and they ignored it. It was a case brought by the Philippines. There was then a change of government in the Philippines, and Duterte is notably more China-friendly than his predecessor was. So the Chinese insist that that arbitration, that court, and that ruling doesn't apply to the South China Sea. And they also, you know, in terms of trying to negotiate a code of conduct with the ASEAN neighbours, there's an ASEAN meeting coming up right now. They've tried to insert into this code of conduct essentially clauses that would settle the territorial dispute. So clauses, for example, that would insist that China has the right to veto military operations with third parties by its neighbours, that China has the right to define who can drill and who can fish in the South China Sea. So, you know, this isn't a code of conduct. This is staking out a claim.
So, I mean, you said that China is becoming much more aggressive, and it is in the way that it's creating facts, well, if not on the ground, then on the water, by building artificial islands, which it's then fortifying and arming. They're doing so, I guess, at an increased speed and with an increased intensity. But do we understand what China sees as the end point of this? Is it the annexation of the entire South China Sea and declaring it Chinese national waters that everybody else has to keep out of?
Or at least that everybody else is there on sufferance. So there are a number of things. There are a number of very important things in the South China Sea. One is that enormous quantities of international shipping go through it, and China has always been a bit worried about, for example, the Straits of Malacca as a potential choke point should hostilities break out between China and almost anybody else, because they're dependent on that waterway for energy. So to control the South China Sea gives you a big sort of counterweight against Japan, for example, or against any other, or indeed against, you know, global shipping in general. That's an enormous power. It's a threat that could be, it's unlikely to be exercised, but it's there. It's a strategic, important strategic point. The second thing is that this is one of the world's richest fishing grounds, and China has the world's biggest distant water fishing fleet. It has trashed its own coastal waters and is fishing very aggressively. And the other is the hydrocarbons. So there is quite a lot to fight for in the South China Sea. And China has now fortified the South China, militarized the South China Sea to a point that, short of war, as one US military expert put it, China pretty much controls it.
Well, finally then, to go back to where we came in, will the Chinese now perceive President Trump as a significantly reduced figure now that he has a House of Representatives, at least, that is presumably hostile to him? Will they be thinking of him as somebody that they don't need to take as seriously as they might have done before the midterms?
I think they will recognise that his domestic agenda is going to get more complicated. But of course, the House doesn't control his foreign policy. And there is
not.
A danger that if he is thwarted and frustrated at home, that he might become more aggressive and play the China card even more strongly than he has in the past. He's claiming, in that rather shambolic press conference the other day, he made the extraordinary claim that there would soon be millions and millions of dollars rolling into the exchequer from taxes the Chinese were paying to the United States, which suggests that he doesn't quite understand how tariffs work, because these would be, you know, monies which would essentially be paid by the US consumer on the imports of goods from China. But I think that the fact that he refers to this as a victory suggests that he's looking for new claims of you know, effective action, and China has been a pretty convenient one for him.
Isabel Hilton, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Police in Melbourne say they are treating as terror-related an incident on Bourke Street in the centre of the city. A man was shot dead by police officers after setting a car on fire and stabbing three passers-by, one of them fatally. Police said that the attacker, a man of Somali origin, was known both to them and to intelligence services, as were members of his family. This latter disclosure has prompted a predictable response from those sections of Australia's press and polity which can be relied upon to affect vapours in such circumstances. Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's and Melbourne's Ben Ryland. Ben, what do we know for sure at this point, some several hours later?
It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so getting very, very close to the peak hour when this incident took place. The man that you described, Andrew, he set his car on fire in the busy Bourke Street. It's one of the busiest streets in the city. It's only a few steps away from the Bourke Street Mall, which is where the David Jones and Myer department stores are. Certainly the busiest shopping strip of Melbourne city centre.
And in the middle of a Friday afternoon, extremely busy.
Extremely busy indeed. Now, this was also right outside the radio station Joy 94.9, which is actually where I used to work some years ago. I know this area of the city very, very well. And Joy, of course, is Australia's LGBT broadcaster. The man who we've seen on video now stabbed three people, as you said, one of them tragically passed away. That video made its way all over the media very, very quickly. It showed the man lunging at police, and the police are clearly trying to subdue him. They're dodging his attacks at them, and then at one point, one of the police officers takes out his gun and shoots the man, who he later died in hospital. The Victoria Police Commissioner, Graham Ashton, told a press conference that the attack was being treated as terrorism. We heard him speaking earlier in the program, and he said, as you mentioned, Andrew, that the suspect, who was aged 31, he was known to federal intelligence authorities as well as to Victoria Police.
Well, do we know anything more than that about what they knew about him and what interest they had taken in him and his family?
Well, in the last few minutes, and I have to say this is only being reported by one media outlet at the moment, but Melbourne's Herald Sun is reporting now that the suspect is the brother of an individual who was accused of plotting a mass murder at Melbourne's Federation Square on New Year's Eve. Now, that's only the Herald Sun that I've seen reporting that at the moment, so we have to consider that it might not have been completely verified by other outlets.
Because that at the time was a very serious case, and the thwarting of what would have been an extremely major attack.
Absolutely, absolutely. That would have been an absolute game changer in the consciousness of Australians, because, of course, there have been attacks of this type in Australia. There has not been an attack of the scale that you might consider in places like the United States or here in Britain or in other parts of Europe. So that would really change things for Australians, I think.
obviously, the key aspect of this is the fact that three people have died. But there will be a significant backlash from sections of the Australian media, because the other narrative in play here is this curious fiction that certain Australian media outlets and certain Australian politicians have been keen to fan about Melbourne in recent years, about African gangs is the key phrase. These appear to be largely a fictional bogeyman, but those elements of the press, can we, and this is an optimistic question, can we rely on them at all to act somewhat more responsibly now that something actually serious has happened?
I would suggest no, because as you suggest, that has been an ongoing dialogue. And if anything, those sectors of the press are going to be more intent on using this to prove their case, that there are sections of the general public who have migrated to Australia, who have not integrated into the Australian way of life, and are posing an imminent danger to the traditional way of what it means to be an Australian. And that sector of the media in Australia has sadly become a little bit bigger in recent times, now that Sky News, the once cable channel, a news channel, and now free-to-air in many parts of Australia, has now overnight become what was a centred, straight-down-the-line news channel in many respects, to a miniature version of Fox News. So, I'm not optimistic that dialogue will cease. I think it might get worse. But certainly the fact that this happened in Melbourne is, I think it's quite different to if it had happened in Sydney. Sydney's media is a little bit more, well, a lot more in many respects, certainly on radio, a lot more right-wing. Melbourne's media tends to be a little bit more restrained about these things. And Melburnians, of course, being one myself, I don't think there'll be many people in the city who saw this who will be immediately thinking this is an African gang thing. This is something that's happening from other people coming outside, from outside of the country to get us here. That's not what Melburnians will be thinking here. I think Melburnians are very, very aware of how many cases like this have already been prevented by the police. Melburnians feel safe, I believe, thanks to the police and the authorities that really keep the city running.
Ben Ryland, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Up next, we meet the author of the one book about America's modern Midwest that you should read if you're going to read one.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, America, as the last few years have reminded us, is a land of maddening contradictions, arguably the most crucial of which is this, that it is an exorbitantly rich country in which live many extremely poor people. The theory that this is why Americans elected president, someone with his own private gold-plated elevator, is debatable, but it did create an entire genre of journalism in which middle-class city journalists safaried nervously into the forgotten rural interior in search of answers. Pretty much all of this has been rendered redundant by Heartland, a new book by Sarah Smarsh, descended from five generations of Kansas wheat farmers. It is a description of modern American poverty that could only have been written by someone who has lived it. Sarah joins me now. Sarah, I was curious about a number of things after reading Heartland, but one of which was what you might have made of all those hand-wringing post-2016 attempts to understand rural America?
Well, that's a great question, and thanks for having me on to address it. I find that most of my fellow journalists are well-intentioned folks, but even with the best of intentions, if you have an enormous blind spot to class as an aspect of American identity, which many folks here in this country that has long failed to reckon with its class structure hold, even your best efforts will be rendered questionable and maybe even downright bad. Journalists, as you said in your great introduction, sometimes in earnest, sometimes with overtly classist attitudes, went into the Midwest or what we call the Rust Belt, areas of the country that are Couldn't be further from New York City in terms of culture. And the fixation that they had tended to be on a particular type of person that was held up as though it exemplified the millions of people in this vast swath of the United States, a white, overtly racist, working class man. In fact, the area that I come from is diverse in racial and political makeup, just like any other part of this country. And so it was a little bit painful to watch, frankly.
You started writing Heartland long before President Trump hove into view. And the book, I should explain to listeners, is an extremely detailed and intimate story of your own upbringing and your wider family and their struggles. What was the point at which you decided that your family story was one that needed to be told?
Believe it or not, even as a kid, I used to tell my family that someday I was going to write a book about them. By the time I was a college student, and so this is some 20 years ago, I was already applying for research grants just to dig up the chronology and the story of my family. Often those sorts of records are lost to the chaos of poverty. And so I sensed already at that time that there was something other about my experience, even in the context of a relatively modest state-funded university. I'm the first person from my family to go to college. And most of the kids I was rubbing elbows with were, squarely middle class. The fact that I came from a poor, small family farm and was raised by people who left school in sixth and ninth grade, made me an outlier in ways for which I didn't yet have a language to articulate. And then it was over the next decade or so when I was working as a journalist and reporting on the public issues and forces that very much shaped my family's private experience that I figured out, oh, class is what this is about.
How have your members of your family whose lives have been chronicled in the book reacted to it, especially since the book has started to get quite a lot of attention? Have they all been entirely happy with it?
I think because I consulted them every step of the way, my immediate family members, of course, it's a rather large cast of characters and the smaller characters, if you will, weren't necessarily involved in the process. But my close family members really helped shape the book. I interviewed them for years to construct some of the passages for which I wasn't even present or born yet. And maybe that's why the book still has their full blessing, and they're quite proud of it, actually. And memoir does not always shake out that way in family dynamics, so I feel quite grateful.
I mean, a recurring theme of those sort of journeys into the heartland that various journalists have made in the last few years has been that one, I guess, going in search of answers as to what any government might actually have done to help these communities out, these ones that always get talked about as if they were left behind. When you were growing up, was there any sense that there was anything that any government could or should be doing for you, or did all this stuff just seem incredibly remote?
I think more so than anything, the latter. We had just a sense of absolute isolation and lack of access or proximity to the power centers of the country. And meanwhile, when you're working in a field every day just to get by, it's a very different relationship to public ideas and discourse. And sometimes it's a lack of connection to that at all. Now, when we did get to talking about politics and government, I would say there was a simultaneous, suspicion of aversion to federal government that is somewhat understandable. If you live in a place where your livelihood is in agriculture and for decades you've watched the federal government make deals with Big Ag that sold you down the river, just kind of a general sense that the entire system was corrupt. And that kind of cynicism, I think, is totally understandable on the one hand and also can be dangerous if we don't work to rectify it and earn the respect of those communities.
You said earlier, and you write in the book, that a lot of the people who have attempted to mediate between an experience such as your upbringing and their they're more urban middle class readers have missed the importance of class in America. Is that something that you and your family were, however, aware of?
I don't think so. You know, when I was talking earlier about not having a language to articulate something in my writing in terms of class, that's in part because, you know, in my experience as a child in the 80s and a teenager in the 90s here in this country, no one was even using that word. You know, I was a bookish kid, as you might imagine, and I remember reading 19th century British novels as a high schooler, and class was very much at the fore of the plot, and I was thinking, what in the hell is this, you know? And the irony, of course, is that my own family was at the losing end of a class structure not so different than what those novels were about, and yet being raised in a culture and a society that claims it's a meritocracy, says that your outcomes have to do with how hard you work. We believed that deeply. So we kind of, on the one hand, knew that something wasn't right because we were struggling as hard as we did. And yet there was no direct reckoning with where we were in the pecking order.
I did want to ask just finally about the way the book is, I don't know if structured's the right word, certainly addressed, because it's not a straightforward memoir as such. It's sort of an extended letter to the child you felt destined and or doomed to have at some point. Why did you settle upon that as the way of hanging the narrative together?
Well, there are a few reasons. One, I wanted to let the reader into just the intimate way in which public forces shape our lives. And what you're referring to, of course, is my relationship to my own physical body as a would-be childbearing vessel. And I was keenly aware of that because I am the descendant of generations of teen pregnancy, which often has its correlations with poverty. And so I grew up with kind of a hypervigilance about that aspect of my gender. And that just aspect of my psyche had everything to do with the intersection of being at once female and poor. And often the stories that are put forth to represent the place I'm from are about the male experience. And I also wanted to show readers how severely these seemingly abstract and economic ideas shape our innermost lives. And I can't say it was comfortable. It's still not necessarily comfortable to talk about, but I find people respond to it.
Sarah Smarsh, thank you very much for joining us. Sarah's book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth, is published by Simon & Schuster. It is also unreservedly recommended. Terrific read. Here are some of the other stories we're following today. Russia is hosting meetings between Afghan government officials and the Taliban in a bid to encourage some sort of peace process into being. Taliban leaders are in Moscow meeting with members of Afghanistan's High Peace Council, the body charged with negotiating an end to Afghanistan's interminable civil conflict. Aficionados of historical irony will recall that Afghanistan's modern instability dates back more or less to the invasion of the country by the Soviet Union in 1979, and that adventure was also the beginning of the end of the USSR. Other countries present at the Moscow talks include China, Pakistan, Iran, India, and the Central Asian stands. UK Minister of State for Transport Joe Johnson has resigned from the government, citing frustration with the Brexit position of Prime Minister Theresa May and calling for a fresh vote. Johnson said discouragingly that Britain was on the brink of its greatest crisis since the Second World War, and demonstrating a commendable grasp of the obvious, observed that what was on offer in the Brexit deal bore little resemblance to what was promised. Joe Johnson is the brother of former Foreign Secretary and pro-Brexit advocate Boris Johnson. Various other Johnsons have been chuntering and exclaiming on social media all evening. The UK's final descent into the town hall meeting scene from Blazing Saddles appears more or less complete. And a Korean pop group may have killed a promising career in Japan, stone dead with an ill-considered wardrobe decision. The colossally popular K-pop outfit BTS have had a major TV appearance cancelled after one member was photographed wearing a T-shirt bearing a photo of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki by the United States in 1945 and the perplexing slogan Patriotism, Our History, Liberation, Korea. This has gone over approximately as well as might have been expected in Japan. TV Asahi, who were to have hosted the group, announced that BTS's appearance was postponed. This is the Monocle Daily. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. The Future City Summit is wrapping up today at the Evergreen Brickworks in Toronto. City builders, planners and leaders from around the world have been gathering to discuss various ways forward. Among them has been Richard Joy, Executive Director of the Urban Land Institute, who joins me now. Richard, I do want to talk about the Urban Land Institute Symposium, which was part of this event. But in general, overall, what do you learn from an event like the Future City Summit? What do you go away from it that you didn't have when you went into it?
Well, I think that the idea behind the Future City Summit was, broadly speaking, a national focus to look at both cities and communities, large and small, across Canada, and how these cities in Canada are going to intersect with technology, especially, but other kinds of forces that are coming our way in the future. As a city, as a country that is, like most countries, despite its vast geography, mostly urban.
So to return to the Urban Land Institute Symposium, what were you focusing on at that?
Well, the idea behind the our symposium, which was called Toronto Urbanism, was really an attempt to take stock of North America's fastest growing large urban region. We're now the fourth largest city in North America. And this has been happening over many decades now, this growth curve, which is really exponential in certain North American terms. But it's happening in a way that we felt perhaps we didn't particularly take great stock of. What are we doing? Who have we become, and where are we going? I think is something that we felt was perhaps not particularly well defined, and so we were going to take a crack at that in our symposium.
So what aspects of Toronto's future identity do you think needed more consideration than they've had so far?
Well, the exponential growth of our city is perhaps one of the great big factors, and one of the great exciting aspects of that growth is that we have we argue that we are the most diverse city in the world. More than for a city of our size, it's amazing that more than 50% of our population is foreign born, not just not from Toronto, but foreign born from another country. So this is an exciting aspect, and Toronto's a very successful city at settling all that immigration. But at the same time, we are suffering from the types of things that economically successful and fast-growing cities suffer from. Richard Florida, noted academic, global academic urbanist, spoke at our symposium and noted that Toronto has now slipped into the top 10 least affordable cities in the world. We have the worst gridlock and traffic congestion in all of North America. This is a continent, of course, that includes epic gridlock such as L.A. We're worse than that now. So really what's happening in Toronto is a lot of very exciting things. And that was really one of the real key points of the symposium, is to take stock of those things, but also to energize ourselves towards tackling some of these really, really deep challenges that are getting, quite frankly, much worse.
I mean, it's not a bad problem to have, obviously, the sort of fretting about the best possible ways of managing success. But that statistic you cite there, that more than 50% of Toronto is now foreign-born, is an extraordinary one, but it is one, I guess, is going to become more common for major cities around the world. What does it strike you that Toronto can teach other countries about integrating immigrants, which generally Canada seems to be better than average at doing?
Right. I think that a major part of our success has been how we've responded at all levels of government. But of particular note has been the municipal realm, which is in some ways the least capable of handling things like vast population growth, because it doesn't have as much financial resources. Certainly, that's the case in with Canadian cities. But the innovation that has come to bear in the use of things like libraries. Toronto, another great stat we love to boast, I think is the only rivaled by Paris in terms of per capita library offering. And when you walk into a Toronto library, one of the most obvious things you are going to note is that these are integration centers for new immigrants in a huge way. They are the place where access to internet, access to books in all languages, of course, and they carry a huge load beyond what you would expect a library to do. But that's something that has been one of our great successes, and there's many others like that that I think have really made our city welcoming and frankly embracing. It was quoted, my favorite quote of the symposium probably was that in Toronto we don't see immigration as a problem, we see it as a solution. And I think there's a lot of impact to that, there are a lot behind that statement.
Richard Joy, Executive Director of the Urban Land Institute, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned.
And the winner is Sally Field.
Marty Ritt is Norma Rae. He has fought all his life to put on films that are courageous, that say things that are part of him, that he feels should be said, that have the box office potential of 75 cents, sometimes less. And I thank him for that. He's taught me a lot. And the best gift that Marty gave me was that he let me feel all the time that I was doing it myself.
Sally Field there accepting her Academy Award for Best Actress in 1980 for Norma Rae. She took the top award again 5 years later for Places in the Heart and scored another nomination for her role as the First Lady in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln in 2012. Sally Field has now written a now memoir titled In Pieces. She spoke to Monocle's Georgina Godwin about how childhood trauma led her to acting and whether she'd always known she would find a home in front of the camera.
Well, by the time, you know, you're ever thinking about what are you going to be when you grow up kind of thought, I think it was always an actor. I can't remember ever having the thought of, gee, I wanted to be a nurse or a fireman or a... I think being an actor was always the top of the list. But I have to honestly say that somewhere lurking, not far behind, but quickly got, you know, diminished till it was no longer visible, was the thought that I wanted to be a writer.
Which, of course, you've now achieved.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you remember the first time you performed?
Yes, I do. Very well. Very well. Clearly. I was 12 years old, and I was lucky enough to have a theater arts department at my public junior high school or middle school or whatever you call it. It was the seventh grade. And it wasn't a stage, even. It was just a classroom that all the chairs and desks were sort of pushed to the side, and we were using the front of the class, and I did a scene from Born Yesterday, played the Billie Holiday character, the brassy bombshell, which I'm completely wrong for, even in the best of gay scenarios, but I remember it clearly, clearly.
And the kind of response you got from it?
You know, I don't remember the response I got from the teacher or the class. I remember the response from me. I remember it so clearly that from the minute I walked on what was supposed to be the stage, something struck me, a little zats of electricity, a bell rang, and the self-imposed fog that I had been living in just cleared, and I could hear myself, and I was alive. It didn't matter what anyone thought of me or what they wanted of me. For this moment, for this second, because it didn't last long, I was free and weightless. And then, of course, it went away, and then I didn't know what to put my hands and any of that sort of stuff. But that exquisite feeling of being alive is what has driven me my entire life. And I would say, long ago, before I even thought of writing this, I would always say that I spent my life chasing the fireflies on the edges of my eyes because it kind of felt just electric. Something brightened and came alive.
And that fog that you described, that's something that would descend. It was a kind of way of protecting yourself from the abuse that you were getting from your stepfather, who himself was an actor to a degree. He was a stuntman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you found a way, really, to protect yourself by just bringing down your own fog bank.
Yes, the fog, the self-imposed fog, I think it was gradual, but it really became the way I lived my life by the time I was an adolescent. Certainly at 12, it was really beginning to be how I saw the world. Very muted. There were no sharp edges or colors. And as a result, I couldn't really read a book or concentrate on schoolwork. I almost didn't graduate because I did so poorly, but I could memorize a poem. And I would memorize the longest poem I could find. In English class, they'd say, now you memorize a poem and recite it to the class. I could do that. I could memorize dialogue. I could go on stage and become, for that instant, alive. And then I would go back into this world that I, the feelings that were overwhelming me would just be tossed out into this mistiness. You know, I had a sense of them, but they weren't sharp and they weren't colorful. But that fog really didn't exist all the time in my childhood. It became more strongly defined as I started to reach adolescence, where my own feelings were coming alive. And adolescence is a complicated time under the best of cases. Since I had a threatening male in the house, it was very dangerous.
And a man who you really loved. I mean, he was a lovely stepfather to you some of the time.
Yes.
But a huge bully in other ways. And I don't just mean the abuse. I mean, all sorts of things forcing you to just work out on monkey bars or swimming and things like that. You say in the book, in fact, that it was more about your failure than your success.
I don't know that it was, but there was a part of me that when I was about 10 or so, I started to pull part of me, not all of me. And it's taken me so long to be able to recognize that part of me was simply fragmenting, you know, because I would feel so distinctly one thing aspect here, and then there would be another aspect someplace else trying to be heard. And some voice and some piece of me started to be suspect that his driving both my brother and myself to accomplish physical feats when we were outside in the backyard, physical feats that in a lot of ways I wasn't capable of. His mockery wasn't about wanting me to achieve something. It was about wanting to see me fail. I sensed it. And whether that was true or not, I don't know. But as I look at it now, through my older eyes, as I started to look at it in my 70s, the 60s and 70s, I think he didn't even see it, but that was the case.
That was Sally Field talking about her memoir In Pieces on The Big Interview. You can hear the full episode on Sunday at 9 a.m. London time, or you can hear it any time you like after that on our website or via iTunes and so forth, or you can subscribe to the podcast. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. We're reviewing the Asian newspapers next.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Time now on The Daily to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by Bruno Garces, BBC World Service's digital editor for East Asia. Bruno, we were talking at the top of the show about how Trump's weakening at home may affect his relationships abroad, especially with China. We have, I guess, the beginnings of an answer in this report of the South China Morning Post, illustrated with a picture of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi, who couldn't look less excited to be shaking hands with each other.
Yes, that's true. Well, what this article says is that now the rivalry and the animosity extends far beyond the ongoing trade war between China and the U.S. And as you mentioned, it's likely to go way further now that Trump is weakened at home.
What does the article sort of give any suggestion of particular possible flashpoints. Is it likelier to be trade, or is it likelier to be such near mishaps as the one we were talking about at the top of the program, this near miss between one American and one Chinese destroyer?
Well, yes, there's that. It's the talks that the Defense Secretary James Mattis will be holding with Yang Jiechi, the top Politburo member, top diplomat, are likely to go from the territorial disputes in South China Sea and the militarization that China is said to be promoting in the area, and it goes up to the human rights abuses in Xinjiang, and also, of course, the trade war and its likely implications.
Okay, moving along to the Korea Joongang Daily. The headline, well, in many respects, is a bit of a dog bites man headline. Pyongyang fumes. When does Pyongyang not? Is the only response. But this, in particular, Pyongyang is fuming at the United States and South Korea for forming a working group on North Korean denuclearization. If North Korea is going to get angry about this, arrogant and disgraceful, and so forth, heinous as well comes up, is it possible we might return to business as usual between North Korea and the rest of the world?
Well, that's the situation we've seen. We've seen in the past, I mean, some apparent moves toward this piece of peace by North Korea, then followed by business as usual. I mean, they could be playing just a game as well. They could be putting an angry face to this just to increase their leverage, which they've also done in the past. So hard to say what exactly is behind this. Is it simply discontent with the fact that of this working group being promoted between the U.S. to talk about North Korean denuclearization as well as the implementations of sanction, or if there's more to come and the derailment of the reapproachment between the U.S. and North Korea.
Moving along to the Hindustan Times, this is a really interesting story. This is I'm not really sure what you'd call it, an administrative hangover, if you will, from the partition of India into India and what is now Pakistan. This is India proposing to sell off what it calls enemy properties. I think probably if you start by explaining what enemy properties are.
Well, these are what they call enemy shares, are the property, land and houses, as well as shares, which equivalent of up to 30 billion rupees, let's say roughly over $400 million, are part of what India calls enemy properties. These are assets that once belonged to people who went to Pakistan and China, and with which India, China also fought a war. So, but the thing is, amongst those nationals of these two countries that were treated as enemies and their assets in India that was seized. Now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been tightening the provisions of the so-called Enemy Property Act, which was approved in 1968, and he wants it even to include lawful heirs who stayed behind and who are actually Indian citizens.
So where is he going with this? Because, I mean, $400 million is $400 million, but in the scale of the budget of a country the size of India, it's not a consequential sum of money, especially. Is this a desperately important thing, or is this just further nationalist rabble-rousing of the sort that we have seen from Modi ad nauseum?
That's certainly what it looks like. That Modi is playing to his base of staunch ultra-nationalists, which is a move that he probably could skip and which is likely to enhance tensions with Pakistan when it seemed that a reapproachment was possible after Imran Khan came to power in Pakistan, and is likely to also enhance tensions with China.
Well, moving along finally to the Asahi Shimbun out of Japan, this is a fascinating position that the governor of Okinawa finds himself in. Denny Tamaki, he's the first person with an American parent, as I understand it, to be governor of Okinawa. And he's hoping to leverage that in with the United States to basically make it clear to him that the Okinawans have become somewhat wearied of the American base on the island.
Yes, precisely. Denny Tamaki says that he is in a privileged position because he's the first American, he's the first person with an American parent to lead Okinawa. His father was a U.S. Mariner, so couldn't be better than that symbolically, because of those roots. And he's been campaigning for this disputed U.S. base in Okinawa to be scrapped and for the military, American military presence to be reduced. This has been an ongoing topic, a big issue in the region since 1995, when a schoolgirl was raped and three U.S. servicemen were convicted for the crime.
Is that the sole source of resentment, though? I mean, not wishing to trivialize what was obviously an absolutely horrific crime, but this is three U.S. soldiers out of tens of thousands that have served on Okinawa, and it was 23 years ago.
I think that's probably when it blew up, but I believe that the situation has been tense not only since then, but it has been an ongoing crisis. It has been an ongoing issue. I think it has to do with national pride, with Japan believing that it can handle itself, that the presence of the soldiers is no longer needed as well.
Bruno Garces, thank you as always. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. It is Friday night, and it is the last item of the show. And that means, well, it hasn't meant for the last couple of weeks because he hasn't been here, but he's back, so it does again. It means Fernando Augusto Pacheco is in with his global chart countdown, in which he picks on some country or other and presents the top five tunes currently topping the pops of wherever that is. Fernando, welcome back. Where are we going tonight?
Well, for the first time, we're heading to Cape Verde. They speak my language, you know, Andrew. They speak Portuguese.
Well, I know this because I have been there one whole time and am therefore an expert. It was 8 or 9 years ago, I think, on assignment for Monocle magazine. I met the then Prime Minister, José Maria Neves, who seemed to me a perfectly affable and competent fellow. It's lovely. The capital city and the prior and the environs around it, beautiful. I recommend it. The food's great. People are as friendly as all heck. I'm not being paid for any of this, but am open to reasonable offers if anyone from the Cape Verde Tourist Board is listening. But what are they listening to, Fernando?
Well, they have quite good taste as well. Not necessarily number five, but let's start on number five. We have to start somewhere, right?
We do.
It's Metro Boomin featuring Travis Scott, and the song is called Overdue.
Overtime and overdue. Ain't no sleep, that is old news. Been outside, that's with the crew. Make my night up on a move.
That wasn't very good. What do we know about the geniuses responsible for this?
Well, we know that the genre is trap music, and I'm not the biggest fan, I have to tell you, Andrew. But Metro Boomin, he's a young American hip-hop producer. Travis Scott is a rapper, so they're doing very well. In fact, the song is very recent. I think it's been released about a week ago. So the Cape Verdeans, they know what's happening in the world of hip-hop and trap and everything.
Well, bully for them. At number four, what do we have?
A little bit better. It's Khalid, not to be confused with DJ Khaled.
Obviously not.
He's also from America, and the song is called Vertigo. Let's hear it.
I do always feel like this segment must come across to our listeners as a slightly upscaled variant on Beavis and Butthead, but that sounded an awfully lot like what was at number five.
He dresses very well. That's the difference. I mean, he's quite a stylish man. So if you type Khalid, amazing haircut and nice collars. I mean,
yeah, but the thing is, like, okay, I'm taking your word for that. I'm literally never going to Google that. But okay, let's just assume that he is a thoroughly well dressed chap with an immaculate coiffure. Good for him, and so forth. And I wish him all the best with it. But why would that make me want to listen to any more of his music?
No, I agree. It's not the best song, but Andrew, I'm saving the best for now, actually.
Well, you are not. This is the record buying public of Cape Verde. third who are doing this.
That's true, that's true. Number three is actually a singer from Cape Verde. She was born in Cuba, but I think she naturalized from Cape Verde. And some people say that she's the new Cesaria Evora, you know, the iconic...
Well, that is some big talk.
It is.
This I know from my time on Cape Verde.
It is big talk, but let's hear it and then we can say if she's the new Cesaria Evora or not. It's Maíra Andrade with Afeto.
See, I quite like that.
Amazing beat, and again, she's doing very well in Cape Verde. I think that's her, I'm not exactly sure, but I think her third album. And, you know, I think she's just excellent. I think she has just a beautiful voice. The video clip is amazing. It's quite high, you know, there's a lot of budget in this
as well. It does have that thing as well that a lot of, I think, Portuguese and therefore Brazilian and Cape Verdean pop music does have that, in contrast or in concurrence with it being kind of upbeat and poppy and stuff, that there is a, I mean, I can't understand the lyrics. It might be about something else entirely, but there is a sense of melancholy underpinning it somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, that's why we have a word called saudade, which is...
That was the word I was about to attempt, yes. But wasn't all that confident about.
Well, here you go. It's longing for something.
Yeah, it's a Portuguese word, if I've got this right, for a sort of ineffable yearning, isn't
it? Yeah, and I think it's a unique word for the Portuguese language as well. I think you can translate in other languages, but saudade is very much used in the Lusophone community. But Maíra Andrade is so happy to see someone like her at number three.
What's at number two?
Something fun is Friday Night. She's French, Malian, and I love this track. It's called Aya Nakamura with Dja Dja. Oh, Dja Dja. Oh, Dja Dja. Yeah, pa moya, Dja Dja. Tu pas ta gata, Dja Dja. Genre, en katana, baby, tu dead ça. Oh, Dja Dja. Yeah, pa moya, Dja Dja. Tu pas ta gata, Dja Dja. Genre, en katana, baby, tu dead ça. It's just so groovy.
That's quite
groovy.
Sweet. Yes. I did not object violently to that.
And I have to say, Andrew, it's been number one in France and the Netherlands. So it's been doing well in some parts of Europe. I wish it could be number one here in the UK as well. Who knows?
But it'd better be quick. There'll be none of this sort of thing after March.
Oh, that's true. That's true. French Malian, perhaps a bit.
No, it won't be allowed. All music will have to sound like the Kinks.
Oh, no.
Which actually...
I mean, it's okay.
Well,
anyway, they're okay.
Yeah, they're okay, okay, fine. Number three is still leading the field for me so far, I have to say. Is it about to be supplanted in my affections by what is at number one in Cape Verde?
I don't think so, but it's a Portuguese rap group, and they have a very interesting name. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's called Wet Bad Gang.
It's called what?
Wet Bad Gang.
Wet Bed Gang.
Exactly.
That
strange,
doesn't
no?
sound like something you would want to draw people's attention to.
But they're apparently the coolest hip-hop group in Portugal at the moment, and in Cape Verde as well, apparently. The song's called Devia Ir, or They Should Go. Let's hear it. Espera que eu vou ter contigo às quatro da manhã. Não era suposto, mas a cabeça só diz go, go, go. Cabeça só diz go, go, go. Às quatro da manhã. They were saying something that his head saying something at 4 a.m. I couldn't quite understand.
Does that have some relationship with the name of the group?
Maybe.
They may have told us more than anybody really wanted to know.
Yeah.
It is, of all the available things in the world, the infinite resource from which you could pluck the name of your group, you would choose to associate yourselves with that.
But listen, look at the top five. We have two out of five, Andrew. There are two quite good songs.
That is historically unusual. So well played, the record buyers of Cape Verde. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, welcome back, and thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Daily. And that is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Ben Rylan and Augustin Macellari. The researchers were Daphne Karnizis and Gabrielle Delasante. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. The weekend edition is live from 8 a.m. tomorrow, which is Saturday. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday, 2200 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.